This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1953.
Desert Island Discs. Every Friday evening, a well-known person is asked the question, if you were to be cast away alone on a desert island, which 8 gramophone records would you choose to have with you? Assuming, of course, that you also had a gramophone and an inexhaustible supply of needles. As usual, this week's castaway is introduced by Roy Plumley.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On our desert island this evening is a musician, a violinist with an international reputation, Campoli. He has the unusual distinction of having reached the heights in 2 entirely different spheres of music, because for some years before the last war, he directed one of the most popular light music orchestras in the country. All right, Mr. Campoli, you've arrived on your island. What music have you brought with you?
Well, I think most violinists would agree on their first choice for a desert island. A record by Yasha Heifetz. There is, indeed, a master.
Mm-hmm. And which one of his very many records?
I was divided between taking one of his early ones to recapture something of the thrill those records gave me as a boy, the discovery that there could possibly be such a technique, or taking one of his recent ones, where the improved modern recording enables one to hear so very much more detail.
Yes, and?
Part of his brilliant new recording of the Concerto No. 5 in A minor by the Belgian composer Vuitton. I remember very vividly being taken by my father to the Queen's Hall to hear Heifetz on his first appearance in this country. It would be about 1920.
Mm-hmm. Was your father a musician?
Oh, yes, indeed.
A violinist?
Yes, he was the leader of the Santa Cecilia Orchestra in Rome and a professor at the Conservatoire.
Well, that explains a lot.
Yes, he was my only teacher. My mother was a well-known dramatic soprano. She had a fine big voice with a wide range and was acclaimed as the greatest Aida of her day in Italy. Mm-hmm. She appeared with Scotti, Caruso, Sarmarco. It was to appear at Covent Garden that the family first came to London from Rome. I was then about 5 years old. Mm-hmm. We all liked London and we stayed.
Yeah. I have an idea this is leading up to one of your mother's records, is it?
Unfortunately, my mother's records no longer exist. If they did, I would certainly have taken one to my island. Instead, I take a record of a favorite aria from Aida. And it's sung by an artist whose voice most nearly reminds me of hers, as I remember it. Renata Tebaldi. Now, let's stay with the music of Verdi for my next record. The prelude to Act 3 of La Traviata.
Yeah. With Toscanini conducting?
Of course.
Good.
It's a wonderful performance. Toscanini, incidentally, in his young days, was a cellist in the same orchestra as my father.
Mm-hmm.
They were good friends. I remember one of my father's favorite stories was how Toscanini got his first chance. That is, if you'd like to hear it.
Well, any story about Toscanini is good to hear, and this sounds like a particularly promising one. Please go ahead.
It was in Rome, about 1890, the beginning of the opera season.
Mm.
The first production was to be Aida, and a famous conductor of the day named Mugnoni was in charge. 24 hours before the curtain was due to rise, Mugnoni had a violent disagreement with the management. Italian temperaments were let loose, abuse was hurled. Mugnoni walked out, complete and utter consternation. Who were they going to get to conduct Aida at 24 hours' notice? The director of the opera house, Tito Ricordi, was walking around in small circles and in a panic. Then a little man sprang up from the cello section of the orchestra and said, "If you're in trouble, I know the opera. I could conduct it tomorrow night." "Who is this young upstart?" said Ricordi. "Impudence." Well, despite frantic efforts, the hours passed and still they hadn't found a conductor. Ricordi had no alternative but to take a gamble and sent for the young cellist. He got the job. He was a huge success, and his name, Arturo Toscanini. Let's hear him conduct the NBC Orchestra in this prelude to La Traviata. Now, let's forget the serious side of music for a bit. There would be times, listening to my gramophone on that desert island, when I'd feel like a little humor. Here's an amusing record by Paul Whiteman's Swing Strings, called Ragging the Scale. This is particularly entertaining for violinists, because the tune which is taken as the basis for this musical rag is the first of the Kreutzer studies for the violin.
Campoli, we've heard why and how you became a violinist, but how did your early days turn out? Did you have hard struggles, or did you find things fairly easy? How was it?
Well, there are very few musicians who don't have hard struggles at some time or another. I didn't have mine in my very early days. You see, I was considered a prodigy.
Mm.
During the First World War, at the age of 9, I gave over 100 concerts organized by the YMCA for the wounded soldiers. And by the age of 13, I'd won 6 first prizes and 2 gold medals at various London music festivals. And on the strength of all that, I was taken under the wing of the late Lionel Powell, and he sent me on concert tours with Clara Butt, Melba, and others. And I also gave a number of recitals in London.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you were doing very nicely.
Oh, very nicely indeed. But unfortunately, it didn't last. The slump of the 20s hit the concert world very hard, and I was grateful to get a job in a cinema orchestra, accompanying the silent pictures.
Then Hearts and Flowers is probably a very familiar tune to you.
As you say.
Where did the cinema job lead you?
Well, it led me to some serious thinking, and I came to the conclusion that there was a greater measure of security in light music than there was in serious music. I badly needed that security, so I formed my light music orchestra and promised myself that it was to be only a temporary measure.
Yes. But surely it wasn't very easy to get back, was it? I mean, apart from having to give up that measure of security, you had to live down your light music success. And I understand that in the musical world, the dividing line is drawn rather sharply, isn't it?
Well, it is in some cases. Uh-huh. But it didn't stop me from appearing at promenade concerts in the Old Queen's Hall with the late Sir Henry Wood and with other symphony orchestras.
Mm-hmm. At the same time that you were running your light music orchestra.
Yes.
Well, what happened then?
The war came along, and Enza asked me to take part in concerts for the troops, hospitals, factory workers, and so on. You know, it was most gratifying to discover that the demand was for the more serious type of music.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
And since then, I've been able to play only the sort of music that I wanted to play. I have been lucky enough to tour many parts of the world, and I have some even more wonderful tours lined up for the near future.
Splendid. Well, what about another record? I think it's time we had another one.
Yes. Well, a record by Horowitz. I always think of him as the Heifetz of the piano. Listen to his amazing technique in Dohnányi's Capriccio in F minor. The emotional and glorious voice of Beniamino Gigli singing Your Tiny Hand is Frozen from La Bohème. I am always thrilled by his magnificent top C on this record.
Could you face up to this desert island experience, do you think? Could you look after yourself efficiently under those circumstances?
Well, I'm afraid I wouldn't be very good.
No?
No, I'm not very proficient at doing things with my hands. It dates back to my youth when I was never allowed to handle a hammer or to do any carpentering in case I hurt my fingers. I'd have to start more or less from scratch.
Yeah. Well, I can quite see that to keep a touch as sensitive as yours has to be, heavy manual labor and boxing and that sort of thing would be out.
Yes, I can assure you it was the cause of a great conflict in my childhood. I adored my music, but I hated being ordered to give up football at the age of 15. I'd always been keen on sport, and for my age, I was showing a fair amount of promise as a soccer player.
So, but for the violin, you might have turned out to be another Stanley Matthews.
Well, I don't think so, not with my weight.
Still, there are plenty of gentler sports, aren't there?
Yes, I've played a lot of tennis, and table tennis, billiards, and snooker, and I'm very keen on bridge. I have recently taken up croquet, and I find it most absorbing.
Yes. And anybody who says that croquet isn't a tough game has never played it.
Yes. As for billiards and snooker, I had the privilege of being taught by Melbourne Inman, which got me off on the right foot. And a good friend of mine is that great artist of the cue, Joe Davis. Which brings me to my next record, A Memory of Evenings at the Green Bay Stable. I've borrowed from the BBC Library a record of Raymond Glendinning describing Joe Davis making a century break at snooker.
And now Joe is having a look to see whether he can force one of the reds just past the pink again into the top left-hand pocket. This is a magnificent cue ball control.
72.
Down it goes, but he can't get the black. There's a red in the way of it, 72, and he's going to try the pink.
78.
He gets the pink with absolute complete assurance of the master of the game that he is, and the score is 78. Now there are five reds left on the table, and he's going to cut one of them into the top right-hand pocket. Rather slower one this time, comes right across. And he's come a bit too far. The score's 79, and this time Joe's cut too far. He's about 6 inches below the pink, and he's covering it about three-quarter ball. He's measuring the distance. He's going to have to take a rest. 79, this is a crucial point. If he's going to get a 100 break, it's a very fine cut now into the top right-hand pocket on the pink. 79 is score.
Yes, I'm always entranced when I see Joe manipulating his magic cue. And you can imagine how delighted I was to hear that he also enjoys my concerts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, now we come to your last record.
Well, naturally, my career is very important to me. And on that desert island, I would like a reminder of the standard I'd reached when I was cast away. You know, you can't do any practicing on a desert island. So, in all modesty, I would include one of my own records.
Yes, which one?
I would choose a recent one, the slow movement from the Sinfonía Española by Lalo.
And that's your eight records. Now, you've one more choice to make, Mr. Camboli. What would you like as your luxury article? You can take any one object you like to your island, but nothing useful. What?
Well, what about a football to help me to keep fit?
But you're not allowed to play football.
Oh, well, I'm allowed to play football on my own, but not with other people. That makes me the perfect desert island footballer. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
You've just heard another in the series Desert Island Discs. In a recorded program, Roy Plumley has been asking Campoli which 8 gramophone records he would choose to have with him if he were to be cast away alone on a desert island. Next week's castaway will be Hutch.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.